This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Yeah, her image subconsciously mocks that lineage, but she's
okay, so that's happening? Mm-hmm. Okay.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're experiencing right now something that's got to be almost unprecedented in American society. Across the nation, in entertainment, in media, broadcasting, technology, the workplace, everywhere, even in politics, more and more every day, we see powerful men being accused of sexual harassment and worse, and they're being held to account for it. Women are speaking up, and they're being believed. In this wave of allegations, some of the most shocking charges were published here at The New Yorker about a group of women who talked about their experiences at the hands of the film producer Harvey Weinstein. Reporting in the magazine recounts behavior by Weinstein that went far beyond harassment. It went straight to outright rape. Those were the accusations, and they're denied by Harvey Weinstein. Ronan Farrow wrote those extraordinary pieces for The New Yorker, and he joined me in the studio along with Alexandra Schwartz, who's been covering the effects of the Weinstein scandal in our society. Ronan, I'd like to start with you, and the issue I'd like to begin with is why, in your experience, women don't bring these charges forward to and are silent for so long, and then what happened? Why has this moment happened when the New York Times and the New Yorker were finally able to get women to talk about, in this instance, Harvey Weinstein, and then obviously this has had a kind of gate-opening effect?
This has been a major theme in our reporting, right? Trying to convey the nuances of why it is so hard for sexual assault survivors to speak, and particularly in cases like this where they're going up against this massive PR apparatus. And it's a panoply of reasons. It's personal reasons to do with the often paralyzing effect of this kind of trauma on an individual level. The women we've interviewed talk at length about the career fears as well. Some of these concerns are pragmatic. It's a whole range. And I think one of the things that has been an awakening associated with this entire moment is people understanding in a way they didn't before just how hard it is to speak.
Well, what happened when you began your reporting? When you went and you probably started hearing about 3-4 women mm-hmm. in the beginning. Obviously, there are many more to come. And when you approached these women, what kind of resistance did you get, or did you get immediate acceptance? What was the process?
Well, you know, a good example is actually the way in which people wavered. This wasn't always linear. Rose McGowan went on the record, told her story in agonizing detail, very painfully. But she then entered a legal confrontation with Harvey Weinstein and became fearful and for a time wavered, and then after that, she was voluble and talking once again. In another case, Annabella Sciorra, the actress, lied to me initially, you know, said nothing happened. And it was only 7 months later, you know, after our initial piece ran, that she called me and broke down and said, actually, here's what happened. And it turned out that story checked out.
Did she describe to you why initially she decided not to talk at all, why she lied to you in the beginning?
She did. Annabella was one of the people to talk about this fear that I think so many survivors of sexual assault have of being branded, of this being the one thing they're known for the rest of their lives. It's you know, an on-off switch for our society. If you come forward with this kind of an allegation, you are always a survivor with a capital S.
That's your first paragraph in your obituary, as it were.
Yeah, I think that's the fear. And, you know, perhaps we're coming to a point in this conversation where it overshadows one less, but I think that's still a very legitimate concern. But, you know, she also talked about the specific fears here of this robust PR machine, a person who is very powerful and very litigious, and as we've chronicled in our reporting, also a really unthinkable, before I reported on this, machine of private investigators and, you know, people operating undercover going after these women. Annabella Sciorra was one of the many women who received a call that she found suspicious from a journalist who turned out to be linked to this whole thing.
But Alex, one of the particularities of this story is that it happened with show business. And in show business, you have a man of late middle age who's basically having one attractive woman after another come in front of him, and he's choosing who shall live and who shall die, who shall get work, who shall not. So placed in this almost parody-like position of power and sexual power. But as we know, this is one instance of many, many, many in many, many fields, and this kind of activity has been going on forever. Is it good that this is broken through with a show business moment, or is there a negative side to that, do you think?
Well, I actually think in some ways it's crucial that it broke through in this kind of field, because this is the first example I can really think of where famous women have come forward as a group and said, this happened to me, this was a problem for me, rather than women becoming famous because they came forward with a sexual harassment or assault claim. I mean, you can think of other cases like the Anita Hill case, where that was the first time I think much of America thought about the concept of workplace sexual harassment. But nobody knew who Anita Hill was before the Clarence Thomas hearings. Nobody knew. That's what she became known for. In this case, we're dealing with actresses who the public knows. And I also think that the public has a really intimate relationship with Hollywood stars. You see them, you know, for much of your own life. You feel close to them in a certain way. That's what acting is. And I think it was huge to have that, you know, that level of public figure be able to come forward.
To both of you, do you think that fame makes an accuser more credible or in the court of public opinion? Is that somehow transferable then to the rest of society?
I think it can cut both ways, you know. People can be more skeptical of Hollywood. It can be unrelatable in some ways. But it is true that anyone in a position of authority and influence, that serves as a signaling mechanism when they come forward. Even, I would say, within that Hollywood community, one of the comments that has stuck with me in this is Annabella Sciorra said in a very small voice, she was in a dark place at that time, you know, I looked at these other women, Gwyneth Paltrow, Mira Sorvino, and I thought, they're so beautiful, they're so poised, they come from great families, it could have never happened to them.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that I think that's one of the reasons why the ball got rolling to the degree that it has, because you could look at women who are extremely accomplished and say, oh, if this is a problem, I think that's part of what Me Too has been about. If this was a problem for someone like her, then wow. It's not just about me personally. I mean, the level of impact goes so far beyond Hollywood and so far beyond, honestly, any particular industry. I mean, many of these stories are personal. They have to do with family relationships. They have to do with friends or romantic relationships. It's not just in these very, you know, public or workplace situations.
Who's to be believed automatically in these cases?
I read something the other day that I think gets at it really well. There's a phrase, believe women. Believe women doesn't just mean automatically believe women, the man's word has no weight. I think it's meant as a corrective to what is often the situation, which is often a sense of not believing women as a default. If you were reminded to believe women as a default, it may help to correct so many of these situations.
You wrote a terrific essay about the Louis C.K. incident, and I've read you for a while now, happily, but I've never heard or seen you write more with a sense of, with rage. I think I can call it that, no?
Yeah, I think so. Fury and rage. I felt betrayed. I think other people have felt this way by Louis specifically.
Why?
Because I thought he was someone, and he may still be someone who in some part of his brain gets it. I was just looking at a joke of his that I linked to in my piece that's a great joke, and he says, you know, men are the number one threat to women. What's the number one cause of death for men? It's heart disease. It's your own heart saying, you know, I can't go on anymore. But for women, you have to be totally insane to go on a date with a man, and our species depends on it. you know, I think he describes it as being, imagine if someone said to a man, oh, you want to go out with like a half bull, half lion or something like that. And so jokes like that, I think, from someone like Louis, who's so smart, really made me feel like, yeah, he totally gets it, and he's able to dissect this whole poison power system from a man's perspective. That is very impressive and rare, and so it feels, you know, it feels so disappointing.
I have to tell you, a lot of men that I know, younger and my age and older too, in this moment have, even though they know themselves to be innocent of anything grotesque or anything on a par of what we've been discussing, is suddenly sort of doing a sort through their romantic history of what jokes did I tell in, you know, 1998 in the workplace, or my breakup with so-and-so, was that – there's a sorting through of conscience that I hear about all the time. And I and the flip side of this, Alex, I wonder what the conversation among women, or women you know, and not just the office, just your friends, and how that's changed from today, from 6 weeks ago.
I think there's shock. I think it's kind of amazement and shock.
But surely this is not the first time anybody's thought about this or spoken of it.
Oh, no.
What changed?
No. The amazement and shock is the idea that that men are thinking about this. This has not been something that men have had to think about as a group or clearly individually. And I think it is good that men are, as you say, are asking themselves, what did I do? Did I do anything? What should I have done differently? What could I have done differently? I'm not in any way advocating for a mass paranoia or a mass I guess I am advocating for mass reckoning, but not for a sense of personal fear and did I do something and did I screw something up. But these are questions. It cannot just be on women to police this whole situation or to ask what is appropriate, what is inappropriate. It has to be everyone. And so I think just the sense that we may not be in it alone is profound.
We also live in a particular political moment where the president of the United States is Donald Trump, who's been accused by, you know, I think upwards of 20 women of some form of harassment, assault even by his ex-wife. What influence do you think, Ronan, that has on this moment and on this story?
Certainly it comes up in my conversations with women bringing forward allegations, you know, that there is a feeling of being fed up. You know, to be a woman in America right now, I mean, I'll let you comment on this, Alex. I can only imagine is an extraordinarily frustrating experience seeing those allegations swirl around and have so little effect.
Yeah, I think the main issue with the Trump allegations to me, I don't really think that it was a belief problem. I think that it was a caring problem. And that was pretty devastating.
In the Roy Moore case, the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, says, I have no reason to doubt these young women. Is that some kind of turning point? Because I have to tell you, in fairness, I'm not sure I would have heard those words from Jeff Sessions a year ago.
Although the way that you just framed that does convey that we are still working from the starting point of not believing women coming forward with allegations like this. I mean, yes, that is a step that is unexpected for me too, but
the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House said the same thing.
I'm happy to hear it. I completely agree with Ronan. It is not enough, but I'm happy to hear it. It is a relief that we can, I mean, you know, that we can establish a fact and have the fact be seen as what a fact is, a neutral truth.
One of the patterns of this drama has been the pattern of accusation, then the doubling and the tripling of accusations, and then comes the apologies. What do you make of the apologies that you've heard from this range of men, whether it's Louis C.K., well, we haven't really heard from Harvey Weinstein on this, but...
Well, I think the first thing that is essential in any case is a sense of acknowledgement. We got that from Louis. He said, I acknowledge that I did these things.
Yeah, what did that mean? I acknowledge it. These things happened.
Well, I think it meant that we could stop the whole debate, the he said, she said debate, so to speak, that we didn't need to go through that step.
Okay, but the women said that you didn't apologize.
Well, he didn't apologize. He acknowledged but did not apologize. I found that interesting. It was pretty frustrating. People have – Louis is not the worst offender on this list at all. But yes, people have pointed out that his statement – made much of the admiration that these women must have had for him and how he had betrayed their admiration. That was not really the key issue.
And also pointed to him asking for permission without addressing the crucial question of whether he got that permission, which did feel like a lacuna to me.
Yeah. In his movie, which now, since it was pulled by the distributor, very few people will get to see, but I was one of those people. I saw it in a press screening last month.
What did you make of the movie?
I found it very bad. I found it very bad. I think I led in my review with...
like brown paper bag afterwards bad or...
Yeah, I mean the first comment in my notebook was they should have barf bags with this movie. So it was it was pretty bad. If you want a case study of the total objectification of women for no purpose, I think this is a pretty good one. But there's a line in the movie where Louis says, "I'm sorry, women." And the Edie Falco character who plays his manager says, "You mean like all women? You're just apologizing to all of us?" And Louis said, yeah, I'm apologizing. Or Louis' character, I should say. I'm apologizing to all women. That doesn't work. And what is very complicated about these situations is that kind of blanket apology, whether it comes from a famous figure who has now been outed or whether it comes from, a person writing on social media in response to the Me Too campaign. There have been various hashtags that men have used, hashtag it was me, or hashtag I did that, as a way of trying in a positive sense to take accountability. But apology and redress doesn't really work that way.
You know, you look at the really large number and growing number of people who have been accused. Let's put Harvey Weinstein off to the side because his offenses seem, for the most part, much greater, or the accusations of his offenses seem much greater than, say, somebody like Louis C.K. Is there in your mind for some of the others any sense of reconciliation, a proper apology, return to the to their roles in society, whether it's in show business or journalism or whatever they happen to do, or is that a concern of the third order?
Yeah, I think it is conceivable that there is a future for them for sure. I don't think we need to live in a society in which, you know, you are exiled for life and that is that, no matter what the level of your offense. There is a big range. I mean, one thing that's been quite extraordinary to see now is how big the range of misbehavior is, but also the fact that things that are not even remotely close to the Harvey Weinstein level can be taken seriously as well.
And should be.
And should be. For someone like Louis, I can see him making work in the future. I certainly don't care about it right now. I don't care what his artistic future is going to look like. And he himself said in his acknowledgement statement, it's his time to listen. That's true. And if he finds a way to make amends and, most importantly, I think to empower other voices, other artists, other comedians, women, whoever, from this moment, I think that would be to the good.
Alex, as we live through this moment and you're thinking about it, what are you also hoping for? What do you hope for the future here? What's the best outcome that you can imagine?
I think growing up, I was really taught if something is wrong, you can speak up and say it. If something happens to you, if something happens to a friend, whatever it is, and then later you find out, oh, well, that's not necessarily true. I would like that to be true. I would like that to be true for my generation, and I would like that to be true for the women in the generation after me, for the girls not yet born. I just want it to become true. That's a high goal, I know, but that's what I feel.
Alex Schwartz, Ronan Farrow, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
You can find all of our coverage of the Harvey Weinstein allegations and their fallout at newyorkerradio.org. In a minute, I'll talk with a feminist icon who's been considering the roots of harassment and violence for a very long time. Bell Hooks joins me in a moment. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I spoke earlier in the program with the reporter Ronan Farrow about Harvey Weinstein and about the wave of allegations of sexual harassment, and much worse, against so many powerful men. And I've got to admit that the problem is much more pervasive and brutal than I ever understood, which has been a very sad and painful thing to realize on a personal level and on a political level. And as men are talking about this problem, one of the names, one of the writers that we keep hearing about is the feminist thinker Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks has been thinking about the roots of male aggression for a very long time, and she addressed it directly in a book called The Will to Change: Men, Masculinity, and Love. It was a somewhat controversial book at the time among other feminists in particular, because rather than excoriating the worst behavior of men individually, she looks at masculinity as a whole, as a kind of regime that oppresses everybody, including men. So when you look at the Louis C.K. incident, for example, or a series of incidents, what does it suggest to you in the broader sense, in terms of the way we live? You've written about men and masculinity and patriarchy and all the rest. What does it suggest to you that we're not talking about quite yet?
Well, you said the key word, David. In all of this, I've read a ton of stuff, and hardly anybody has used the word patriarchy. Because in part, we want to act like this is individual male psychopathology and not like this is normal. And I went back to my 2004 book, The Will to Change: Men and Masculinity, and it's so much about how we raise males to believe that violence is how you get what you want, and that you have a right to violence.
You talk in that very book, in The Will to Change, you talk in the book about being a child and noticing the differences in how you and your brother were raised, starting at a very young age. Can you talk about some of those differences in order to, in a sense, begin a discussion of what patriarchy is and how it traps men and women?
Well, and
I
shapes
mean,
us.
My father, who was a very violent, very patriarchal man, he was in the all-black infantry in World War II. He was a boxer. He was a basketball player. He was all of these things that we associate with masculinity. And in fact, really had a lot of disdain for my brother, because actually my brother was a much softer, warmer human being. And my father looked down on that. He felt that was not masculine.
But when you're reading about and watching the news in the last few weeks, how does this all relate to the creation of patriarchy? How are these manifestations of patriarchy? Somebody, the Louis C.K. incident, the incident with various editors all around the country behaving in this way in newsrooms, not just Harvey Weinstein.
Well, what I would say about all of these men is that if we could research their childhoods, we would probably find that they have been the victims of some kind of trauma and probably some kinds of sexually related trauma. I think many, many, many males are abused as children in ways that we cannot talk about.
Well, one of the reasons that you got criticized for that book sometimes was that it seemed too sympathetic to men in some cases. Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. I mean, I still think that if we really want patriarchy to change, we are in trouble if we turn our backs on men and not really want to examine why are men so violent. John Bradshaw used to say that the primary form of child abuse is really shaming. And I think that if we look at all of these men and their behavior, it's such shaming behavior.
So I think what you're saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because it's essential here, that rather than looking at this as a series of cases and outliers and marveling at the great number of them, we need to think of it in systemic terms. That this is the way.
Absolutely,
this,
David.
This is the way we all are. So how do we not live like this any longer?
Well, one, we've got to be willing to challenge the way we parent. I mean, one of the things that I say to people, patriarchy has no gender. Just because a boy is being raised by a mother doesn't mean that that mother isn't patriarchal in her mindset, that the mother isn't telling that boy, you need to be a man. You know, you need to be a better man than your loser dad. And I can remember when dozens of mainly white feminist women were very concerned because they were having boys. And how will we raise these boys to be different? And after a while, you know, oh, my son wants a gun. I just can't keep it from him because all the other kids have guns. I mean, that's the interesting transition that we made away from caring about the masculinity of boys. I mean, they didn't want to see a correlation between what we take into ourselves about masculinity and how it's acted out.
Bell, what is the next step then? You talked about parenting, obviously, as essential to shifting away from standard patriarchal relations and assumptions and understandings. What about on the political level?
Well, I think parenting is political. I mean, think about how many thousands of children are being dealt with violently in our society every day. I don't think, you know, I feel almost like I can't really be heard in emphasizing that this has to begin on the level of family.
Why do you say you can't be heard?
Because I don't think people want to acknowledge. I mean, you know, initially when all of this stuff started with Harvey and other people, I kept thinking, I wouldn't be surprised if all of these men were not the victims of child sexual abuse. I mean, think about the movie Spotlight. Think about how much more common the abuse of boys is than people want to believe, and that it impacts how they deal in the world.
Bill, a final question is that most of what you suggest, a lot of what you suggest has to do with the psychological interplay between family members. This is not something that is easy to rectify. It's not something that can be changed very easily with a spending program or a new form of pedagogy in the schools. What's to be done?
Well, first of all, I think that all of the work that's being done on emotional intelligence is focusing on how closed off men are. And of course, we now have a government of closed off men. And so I think that we need, I'm a big fan of therapy. The men that I respect the most who have changed, whether they're gay, straight, trans, have been men who engage therapy so they can grow emotionally, so that they can be in touch with what they feel, so they can feel. I think these men that we're talking about are not men who feel, you know? And I have been a Louis C.K. fan in terms of his comedy, but I think you can see him as a harsh, kind of unfeeling man in the way he constructs his comedy.
Did you feel the same way about Bill Cosby when you were listening to his comedy?
Hated Cosby from jump. He was too good to be true.
Bell Hooks, thank you very much.
Okay. Bye.
Bell Hooks is the author of The Will to Change, Men, Masculinity, and Love, along with dozens of other books of poetry and theory and children's fiction as well. Now, last year I had the pleasure of speaking on stage with one of the artists I admire most in music, Bruce Springsteen. One of the things we talked about was his very difficult relationship with his father, a true patriarch of the old school. Bruce's memoir, Born to Run, had just come out, and I asked him to read a passage from it.
Okay, here we go. Unfortunately, my dad's desire to engage with me always came after the nightly religious ritual of the sacred six-pack. It was one beer after another in the pitch dark of our kitchen. It was always then that he wanted to see me. It was always the same. A few moments of feigned parental concern for my well-being, followed by the real deal. The hostility and raw anger toward his son, the only other man in the house. It was a shame. He loved me, but he couldn't stand me. He felt we competed for my mother's affections. We did. He also saw in me too much of his real self. My pop was built like a bull, always in work clothes. He was strong, physically formidable. Toward the end of his life, he fought back from death many times. Inside, however, beyond his rage, he harbored a gentleness, a timidity, shyness, and a dreamy insecurity. These were all the things that I wore on the outside. And reflections of these qualities in his boy repelled him, made him angry. It was soft. He hated soft. Of course, he'd been brought up soft, a mama's boy just like me.
Princess cards she sends me with her regards. Oh, barroom, I shine fake.
On the New Yorker Radio Hour next week, my conversation with Bruce Springsteen. You're absolutely welcome. And for today, we'll be back in a moment with yet another very complicated relationship between a father and a son, this time courtesy of Noah Baumbach. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In his review of the Meyerowitz stories, New and Selected, film critic Anthony Lane paraphrased no less an author than Leo Tolstoy. Anthony wrote, "All happy families are alike. Every unhappy family, in its own way, belongs in a Noah Baumbach movie." As a writer and director, Baumbach's got a particular feel for family dynamics and for characters who are incredibly messed up and exasperating, but they're as real as the people around you. We've seen it in movies like The Squid and the Whale and Margot at the Wedding. The Meyerowitz Stories stars Dustin Hoffman as an artist long past his prime, and Adam Sandler plays one of his sons, and all three Meyerowitz children are in the movie, each of them miserable in his or her own way. Noah Baumbach came into the office recently and sat down with The New Yorker's Susan Morrison. And they started out by talking about Baumbach's history with the magazine.
You just talked about your time being a messenger here, and that was part of this sort of old golden age of The New Yorker before faxes and email. And tell us what that gig entailed. Was it a little glamorous?
It was, I think it was the summer between my sophomore and junior year. I was at Vassar, and it was just the best job. We would come in every morning, and there would be all the newspapers, so we would read all the newspapers, and we'd sit there, and we'd all just talk, and there was a lot of downtime, so I would also, like, start trying to write things, and there was typewriters, and Bruce, who ran the messenger room, you know, every so often then would, like, point at you, and you would get a certain amount of money to go generally proofs to one of the writers. There was Andrew Porter was uptown. Arlene Croce was in Brooklyn.
So you didn't really want to go to Arlene Croce's in Brooklyn, I assume.
No, because we got less money for that because the idea was it was cab money, and would then all just take the subway or walk, and then we would pocket the rest as sort of a tip.
Well, I think this is, especially editing and writing, it's something you really can learn a fair amount by osmosis. You know, just being around these people and listening to the editorial conversations, and that sounds like a great gig for a college kid. When I first heard that your grandfather, Harold Baumbach, was an artist like the character Dustin Hoffman plays in the Meyerowitz stories, I looked him up online, and there's a Times obit of your grandfather that uses a very striking phrase. It says that Baumbach was allergic to success, which is such an amazing thing to have in an obit. And it occurred to me, wow, that could have been a great alternate title to Noah's movie.
Allergic to success,
because
yeah.
Everybody in the movie is struggling with this idea of what it is to be successful. Obviously, Harold Meyerowitz doesn't think he's been successful enough. And his two sons, one played by Adam Sandler, is not conventionally successful, but he views himself as a successful parent. And his half-brother, Ben Stiller, is successful at making money, but doesn't seem to be successful at any kind of human relationships.
I'm not splitting the time like I did at 15.
It was very important to me after our separation that I see you half the time. I wanted to make it up after Danny and Jean.
And make it up to them.
I made a real effort with you. Danny and Jean, I could have done better, but I don't see anything significant I could have done better with you.
Really? Nothing?
Oh, come on, Matthew.
You feel like that all was great. Danny definitely got and Jean didn't even get, but I got your focus. And that me up in a whole other way.
Matthew, we never see each other. Let's not fight.
I keep thinking I know how to handle you now, but then I see you and I get suckered into your all over again. Your career, your jacket, and then when I try to actually help, like today, you won't listen.
I don't see how I could be such a bad father. Look how successful you are.
Right.
I could never be the businessman that you are.
Okay.
I've said to Marina, I don't know who Matthew takes after. I certainly didn't know how to make money.
That's right. I don't take after you. None of us do. You had to be the only artist in the family. And it doesn't matter that I make money because you don't respect what I do.
What do you need my respect for? The world respects you because you make money.
Ugh, I want to punch you in the nose.
I know you think you can treat me this way because of your money.
I mean, talk about success and what you're trying to say about it in this movie.
Well, it's interesting actually to think about allergic to success, and I'm not sure who came up with that phrase, but allergies are, by definition, it means it's out of your control, I guess, is in some ways. And I would maybe, it sort of almost takes away the responsibility from him, you know, as if he, you know, was cursed in some way, right, as opposed to somebody who was more self-destructive. And but I think in some ways that goes into the Dustin's character in the movie, I think, feels in some ways that there is some, you know, whether it's the culture is against him, or it's the wrong moment, or, you know, the critics, or whatever it is at any given moment that's not going his way is keeping him down, as opposed to, you know, figuring out what his role in all of this is. But the movie itself, I think, I felt was sort of about how we, in ways that we define success, you know, and ways families kind of set the bar in a way, you know, either implicitly or explicitly, and right, and leave it to us to sort of measure ourselves by these standards. And you know, as you say in the movie, you know, being a good parent isn't really valued by Harold, by Dustin's character. Making money is not even really valued, right, and it's really it's all put on art.
Right. Right, and none of his kids feel that there's any room for them to be artists.
It's something that only he can win at. You know, right, he can win in the family if he feels like he's losing in the outer
right
world.
So even though he professes in the movie to be disappointed that none of his children are artists, there's really no way he could have ever allowed them to be.
Right.
Now, the title of the movie is The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected. And obviously you're playing with the idea of a short story collection here. But as I watched it, I kept thinking the movie also shows that each character has a story that he insistently tells himself over and over, almost to survive as consolation. Were you thinking about that as you put the movie together?
Yeah, how these stories are both, they become, in the case of Harold, they're soothing. He goes to, you know, LJ, his contemporary, who's got a, you know, who's very successful and has a retrospective at MoMA, and afterward he has to put LJ down, and he kind of goes through this whole thing of what's wrong with the work and why it's popular but not really interesting, you know. And I always saw those things. That was my direction to Dustin in a lot of cases, was you're soothing yourself. You're going into a kind of rhythmic loop that is very available to you. You know, you have the words for it.
Ultimately, LJ is a popular but minor artist. There's a superficial bravura, but there's no unconscious, no discovery. I know you like the Bears, but it's the reshuffling of obnoxious cliches, like listening to music played slightly off key.
I didn't get to see it.
And the video work is embarrassing. I've never forgiven LJ for using Loretta in those pieces. You don't do that to a child. And it's a disturbing commentary on the culture that truly ordinary work, made mostly by his assistants, gets reverent reviews from the critics, who ought to know better. He's a talented, pretentious enigma.
Let me see if there's a cab.
It's also something I'd wanted to do in a movie for a long time, and I've tried it and never found the right context for it, which is to repeat stories, have people tell the same story over again, and actually have to like sit through it again, and, you know, or tell the same joke again as well. And this became a great way to do it, because it's what we all do in families anyway. People, every year you gather around, somebody's telling the same story again, and you know, you're both like telling the history of the family, and it kind of can bring people together, but it also can become total obfuscation and changing the narrative.
It's interesting in the movie how a lot of these stories that we hear characters repeat over and over again, they're actually wrong, you know, and this is the character's attempt to rewrite history so that, in some cases, so they don't feel so guilty. But these wonderful repeated bits, which is something we all know from our own loved ones, you know, hearing the same joke, whatever, it's what gives these characters such a lived-in kind of feeling, I think. Another thing about these characters and their stories is Well, all of your movies are, I think of as being full of fast-paced dialogue. But what is new in this one is the way characters talk over each other and past each other. None of them are actually connecting. It almost seems like some kind of dissonant jazz where the melodies never intersect. And again, that's so realistic. And yet, I can't think of another movie where the dialogue works that way. Can you? Were you inspired by
anyone else? Something like His Girl Friday, in a way, is maybe like the closest thing. Another one of my directions is faster, because I do find that the writing, or my writing, works better faster. I noticed that when I was, remember, starting out, and like sometimes you do like a speed through, like where you're, you know, let's just say it as, you know, let's speed through it as fast as we can or something. And I always felt like, oh, that should be the movie, is the speed through, not the, not when we're actually acting it. We should do the speed through. And so I've kind of designed them more that way, I guess, as I've gone. And, you know, a lot of the, if you read the scripts, it's a lot of overlapping dialogue. And it's sort of like what you say is actually, because you were saying it's sort of like jazz, but also very realistic. But somehow when we do it, if we do it right, it simulates reality, but to get there is completely artificial.
Well, you're known as a director who expects his actors to read every line in the script verbatim. And I'm thinking about your cast here, if Dustin Hoffman, Ben Stiller, Adam Sandler, all people who are known for improvising. Was that a challenge to get them to stick to what was on the page?
Not in this case. They were all up for what this was, you know. And Ben, of course, had worked with me before, so he knew. But the problem is if people start adding things, even if they start adding ums and you knows or things that are, you know, might on the face of it make it sound more natural for them. It just sounds wrong to me. It throws the whole thing off.
The rhythm.
Yeah, it does.
Right.
And so it's not out of any kind of, you know, stubbornness or this feeling that I feel like, oh, well, you know, what I've done is better than, it's more like, this is the way I know how to do it.
Now, I read one critic who said, was commenting how fantastic Adam Sandler can be when he's not acting in an Adam Sandler movie. I mean, Sandler's incredible. I hope he's nominated for an Oscar for Meyerowitz Stories. But your influence as a director is obviously really, I mean, you can see it. He gives a very different kind of performance than he does in his other comedy movies. How do you account for that? Or what's your technique with someone like that?
Well, it was really, you know, it's all there. He's an extremely warm, sensitive person. And I would say the only like hurdle we had in rehearsals was me giving him permission in some ways to be funny, to be himself. I think like when we first started, he was reading it. It was very good, but it was
more tragic.
Yeah, it felt a little like, also it also felt like he was holding back in some way, because I think he was trying not to, you know, he didn't want to mess it up. I think he felt a kind of responsibility. He didn't want it to be, you know, maybe in his head, like an Adam Sandler character.
Right.
My feeling was it should have a relationship to that guy, you know?
Right. In the Meyerowitz Stories, the character of Eliza, the college-age daughter of Adam Sandler's character, is a college-aged filmmaker. And it seems to me that she's the only character in the movie who doesn't seem ashamed. She does her work wholeheartedly, without conflict, and it's almost a redemption, I think, of the whole Meyerowitz line of everybody being so tormented.
Slap, slap, slap.
Slap.
Boing.
Jean, that's you with the rabbit.
Shh, you're gonna miss it.
Kiss. Slap. Something changed inside me that day. The end?
Jean,
You were so good.
She's got real chops.
I was well-edited.
That's wonderful, honey. I don't know that I've seen a sex scene shot quite like that before.
I used deliberately very harsh, direct light. I wanted to appear very unattractive.
Wonderful mise-en-scene.
For my Jeopardy parody I did at my office, we just had to use the overhead fluorescents.
Yours had wonderful mise-en-scene as well, Jean.
Thanks.
And this is your best yet, Eliza.
Thanks, Dad. I've made 8 more since then.
I'm in 5 of them.
And she's also the only person in the movie who was really taken care of. Do you view her as this redemptive look into the future?
Yeah. A result of Danny's true success as a parent, right, that he was the buffer between all this stuff, you know, all the sort of legacy of his father, and you know, whatever pain it's caused him, he didn't pass it on to her, and I thought just that she's unashamed, and that, you know, art making is not complicated for her. She's just doing it. You know, she's doing it, and she's going to keep doing it. And it's not, you know, with a goal in mind, or you know, she's not hampered by all this other Meyerowitz stuff.
Now, you shot this movie on film, but the movie's being distributed by Netflix. I saw it on the big screen. I urge everyone at home to see it on the big screen. But do you have any anxiety or misgivings about the idea that a lot of people are going to watch it on a small screen or on a computer?
Well, I feel the same way. I mean, I think, you know, I made the movie independently, and I wouldn't know how to not make it for a big screen. I mean, I think that's so much of what, you know, why I make movies in a way too. You know, I just think it's such a singular, unique, important experience seeing a movie in a theater. Yes. There's something about having an emotional experience
with other people.
Yeah, in a
communal
big,
experience.
In a big dark room, and that, you know, you're vulnerable in a different way than you are sitting at home with your feet up and, you know, pausing it to go, you know, right, pour another glass of wine or whatever.
Having your phone buzz.
Yeah.
I just realized that as we've been analyzing all of the details of this family dynamic and the, you know, Tolstoy's unhappy families, that we're making it sound incredibly grim. This is actually one of the funniest movies I've seen in a long, long time. So I just want to make sure that gets across.
Writer and director Noah Baumbach talking with New Yorker editor Susan Morrison. Baumbach's movie, The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected, is out now on Netflix and in theaters. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm David Remnick. And here's Erica Jong.
We're sitting on Central Park West and 78th Street, and we're right near the Museum of Natural History. And we came here because I grew up right in this area. I grew up in a building facing the Museum of Natural History. And in some ways it was the same, but in many ways it was different.
Jong is the author of a dozen books of fiction plus works of nonfiction and poetry. But none's more famous than her debut from 1973, Fear of Flying, a story about a woman coming to terms with her zipless sexuality. And it was quite controversial at the time. The book reflects Jong's own life and her upbringing and identity as a native of New York City.
You always see tourists coming out of buses and going to the museum sort of with stars in their eyes. And I try to figure out where they're from. And you can sometimes tell, but often you can't. Very rarely do you see anyone wearing a sari or a kimono. Everybody is homogenized. That's sort of disappointing in a way. My grandfather, because he was a painter and worked at home, and we all lived together in one of these studio buildings with north light on the other side of the museum, my grandfather often used to take me into the museum on the 77th Street side, and there was a hollowed wood canoe, and the light was kept very low in the museum. And I would look up at the canoe with the shadowy figures and become terrified. And Papa said, "Don't be scared." But the figures, you couldn't see their faces. I know how important grandparents can be. They have more time for you than your parents. They have time to sort of wander with you and go to museums and travel with you. They gave me so many things that became part of my understanding of life. The Museum of Natural History was also very magic to me because I knew that in one of the turrets Margaret Mead worked, she had her office here. And I always used to see Margaret Mead walking along Central Park West carrying a staff that had been given to her by some group she studied. She really understood what it meant to be a woman who wanted children, but also wanted to make her work primary. And in one of her memoirs, I think it was Blackberry Winter, she said, "I went to the library and I looked up all the women I admired." And she said, "And I noticed that each of them had one child, and I decided I could do that." And when I got pregnant with Molly, my daughter, I thought, if Margaret Mead could do it and go on with her work, so can I. This is too funny. Little kids, like 3 and 4, pushing each other in a stroller.
Fast,
okay. This has always been a neighborhood for kids. We used to call it the Planetarium Park. God knows if what the real name is. It surrounds the planetarium. There's plenty of greenery for kids to run around on. And maybe that's the good thing about this neighborhood, that there's so many places for children to play. We're on 77th Street, West 77th Street, which is the street where I grew up. The building I grew up in had been built at the turn of the 20th century as a building for artists. My grandfather painted portraits and movie posters for MGM, and I painted by his side. As a little girl, I was supremely confident, and I think my confidence came from the fact that I was adored by my grandfather and my father. I never come here without thinking of myself as a child, but perhaps the best part of it was when my 3 grandchildren from Molly, my daughter Molly Zhang Fast, were little. I brought them to the museum all the time. The great thing about being a grandparent is you see your childhood reimagined through the eyes of your grandchildren. I mean, they teach you about the world and you teach them about the world. It's the great reward for getting older, really. Look at these marvelous hydrangeas. They're in the museum park. They're the, so it's called Margaret Mead Green. I thought it was called the Planetarium Park, but it's been renamed Margaret Mead Green. Good for her.
The novelist and poet Erica Jong in Manhattan. I'm David Remnick. Thank you for joining me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. And next week, Bruce Springsteen joins us. Have a great Thanksgiving.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.